Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's finally got his blue passport. It's Richard Herring! Thank you, my fan friends. Thank you very much. Welcome. Thank you. Oh, wow, you're way better than last week's audience. So it's much better. Much better than them. Welcome to the show. This is Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre Podcast. It's the last show of this series. It's the last recording of 2022. People who are listening at home will be in the future in 2023. Imagine that. Wonder what terrible... Which, how many prime ministers they'll have had by then? What did you say? There'll be space flight by then. There is space flight already. Yeah, okay. There will still be space flight in 2023. Yeah, you did get excited, but it's nice. It's nice that you woke up from being in 1952. It's Rich Chance, Leicester Square Theatre Podcast. But I was talking to my Tamagotchi the other day. I must have done that before. I must have done that one before. He calls it Ralastapa. Still alive. I've kept him alive. I finally got my blue passport. That's what I voted for Brexit for. We can go back in the EU now. I just wanted my blue. It's arrived. It's as blue as the Ace of Spades. I have to tell you, it's as blue as the midnight sky. So blue, it's so blue you can't even see the blue in it. That's how it was all worth. It's the most shoddily made piece of shit I have ever seen. Literally, you can't lay it flat, it's open up, it feels like it's been made. There's things that my 5-year-old son brings back from reception that are better made. I'm not even joking than that. It feels like it has been made by, and apparently it's not made in the UK, made in France. So it's a good job we left, isn't it? That's why it's a good job we left. They can't even make a decent passport. We've been watching the World Cup. It's the World Cup. People at home will know how. Has it come home? It's the future. I think it's. I think we're going to do it. I think, you know, I know I shouldn't be watching it. I'm sorry. I'm watching it anyway. But I was watching the England-USA game with my kids, who were not very interested, and there wasn't much on screen to get them interested. My daughter had quite a lot of ideas. She's quite got into football, and she plays football, and she wants to be a professional footballer now, thanks to the Lionesses, I have to say. She plays in a local team. She's very good. She was coming up with hacks. She was trying to hack football, and she said, why can't people balance the ball on their back, and then no one will be able to get it, and then they could just carry it? It's quite good. Said if you could do, or just on the top of your head. But I thought they could evolve a human being with a sort of dip in their back, like a ball shaped hole in the back, and then it could be just in there, and then because people would be trying to kick it out, it'd be hard, wouldn't it? Then just she also thought people should just go on each other's shoulders. I think was one of her ideas. I said they probably thought of most of these, but I don't think there's any law that says against it. I admire her for not, she doesn't want to put the work in. All she has to do is learn how to balance a ball on top of her head. And she could be in the Lionesses. That's what very exciting. Good, look, we'll crack straight on. We have an absolutely fantastic guest this week who is probably best known for playing Rosie Jarrett in Frontiers. That's why we're here, back in the 1990s. What's she been doing since then? She was also, as many of our guests have been, in Robbie the Reindeer, Close Encounters of the Herd Kind. I will one day have interviewed every single person who was ever in that, who is still in. Will you please welcome the amazing Sophie Ellis-Bextor, ladies and gentlemen. Sophie Ellis-Bextor. She's like a superstar.
That made me laugh so much. Yes, I was in Frontiers.
Frontiers, one of your...
Frontiers.
You write about it in your book. You're with Joey from Bread and the director of Sliding Doors.
That's right.
Peter Howitt.
Yeah, he played my dad.
Yeah.
And I was so excited to get the part because I really wanted to act at that time, and this is the first acting role I'd ever got. And there was a really awkward scene where... I mean, I was 15 and I think I was probably already pretty 5'7" or something.
Yeah.
And I had to lie on a sofa... And then my dad, Peter, had to say something to me, and then I had to go, carry me up to bed. And even at the time, I knew that was ridiculous. Carry me up to bed. I was like 15. Yeah. I mean, okay.
Did he manage it? Yeah, I mean, my daughter's 7, and I think the days of carrying her up to bed are almost... I can get her up one flight of stairs.
It's so true. My 10-year-old, no way could I pick him up.
So that's a sad thing, though. There's so many terrible things with having children. I know you've got so many children, but it's a sad day when you... You probably don't even know the last time you carried them upstairs, and then it's gone, isn't it?
I did read an article about that once, actually, about the last time that everything happens, because we speak so much about the first times. But then... I think then you're busy doing whatever the new thing is, aren't you? It's not like everything just sort of goes quieter and quieter. Like new things come in the scene and... Nah. No?
I'd just like them to stay this age for good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So what, are they 5 and 7?
5 and 7, yeah.
Those are sweet ages. Yeah.
It's too... I can't bear to think of it, but, you know.
It's nice, though, when they get older and you can have chats with them and stuff. I do like it. My oldest is 18.
I chat to them now.
Yeah, it's
Sophie.
True. But it keeps going. The conversations keep going.
I'm sure.
I like it.
I know. Well, it's an incredible... You've got 5 sons.
I know. It's funny,
incredible,
isn't it?
Incredible, prodigious. Now, I think it's... As you know, we'll mention this right at the start.
Mm-hmm.
I am in love with your mum.
I know.
And I've loved her for 40 years and I still love her.
Yes.
And she is... she's the most beautiful woman in the world, okay? And no offence to my wife. If your mum wants to get together with me, just tell her to give me a ring and I'll divorce my wife and leave my kids and I'll be right over.
It's funny because my mum was going to come tonight and the last minute she was like, actually, no.
But then she's had, she's had a daughter. I mean, more than one daughter. But and then now you should have a daughter for the next generation.
I see.
And you've had 5 boys and I think you have to keep going.
Denying.
You've got to keep going until you've produced the next generation's Janet Ellis.
Okay.
For the next generation. It has to be the next generation. So please keep going.
All right.
But your dad directed That's Life. I'm more interested in that now. I didn't realise. Did he bring vegetables home and stuff, funny-shaped vegetables home with him?
It's funny, my memories of That's Life, well, I've got a few. One of them, actually, is that, well, there was a dog that could say sausages.
I think that was
really famous at the time.
It really was.
It was this... Does everybody know about the dog that could say sausages? Oh, great, see? Legacy. Sausages. Exactly. Sausages.
He had to move... The bloke had to move his fingers. So it's... sausages. That's what that was entertainment in the 90s.
Yeah, in the 80s. And there was another bit, actually, where me and some of Esther Ranson's children sang a rendition of I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles that they used in the title credits for about 6 weeks.
Wow.
Which I tried to find, actually, on YouTube because I thought it would be hilarious, but I couldn't.
Right.
But if anyone seeks it out, I'd be quite keen to see. I think I was wearing a really bright pink puffer jacket.
Oh, it's got to be there somewhere.
Swaying.
I mean, That's Life. It was huge, though, right? It was huge. It's sort of one of those things that's... It's not been forgotten, but it's been sort of...
It's kind of an era, I think.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
So I don't really exactly remember exactly what it's about. Was it kind of consumer issues mixed in with sort of funny stories? It's a bit of everything.
It's sort of just a lot of double entendres.
Yeah.
So it was quite, you know, there's that nice clip that goes around of the guy who rescued all the kids from the Nazis, all the Jewish kids, and then he's in the audience and then they're all around.
It was It's
an absolutely beautiful, beautiful tear-jerking clip. So there was lovely things in it, and then there was Cyril Fletcher sitting in a chair.
You didn't get to the bit in... Because Richard was telling me that you're... Did you say halfway through my book or something like that?
Yeah.
You haven't got to the last chapter where I just do lots of embarrassing stories.
I have not.
I do just, like, 10, just really, like, all the most embarrassing things that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
And one of them is a direct result of the fact that my dad used to direct.
Tell us.
Because every Christmas we used to go to Esther Ranson's house for a big Christmas party. And one year, for some reason, my stepmom couldn't come, so it was just my dad and I. And I think this time I was about 16, and I'd sort of discovered by then alcohol. So I turned up, and you know, when you're a bit grumpy about coming to like your dad's work do, I was like, I don't really want to be here. I want to be out clubbing or something. I don't know. And I got offered some pink champagne, and I genuinely thought it was non-alcoholic because it was pink.
Right.
So I quickly drank 3 glasses, got really drunk really quick, tried to rein it in, drank some black coffee. Nothing was happening. And as we left, in front of all the guests, I fell down the main staircase and shouted fuck at the top of my voice. My dad and I couldn't talk about it for years. Years, like decades.
Esther Ranson, I love that. That's basically what's that like. That's life in a nutshell, that is.
It was so embarrassing. So embarrassing.
So it was quite an interesting childhood, and you say in the book that you sort of felt you were... It's a great book, by the way. It's called... Spinning Plates.
I can help you.
And
you
it's, yeah,
that.
That's all right.
I'm
very tired. I nearly called your famous song Groove Armada by backstage. So, you know, I'm a little bit tired. It's been quite a long... my son's got tonsillitis. It's been a terrible time for me. Still, even though he had it last week, he's still got it this week. What was I going to say? It's a fantastic... Did you really... With the book, you say at the beginning that you... when you're doing the audiobook, I was listening to the audiobook, and you said at the beginning, it'll be interesting to read this out loud because I just wrote it all in one go.
Pretty much, yeah.
And you can't remember what's in there.
If it's a recommended technique.
It's very good if you literally just sat down and wrote the book. I mean, it does feel very chatty, but in a good way.
Well, I just thought, I don't know how else, I've never written a book before and I don't know how else to do it. So I didn't write chronologically. I would sit down and write whatever I was in the mood to write that day. And so there were all these different chapters. So some of it might be just about like all the worst haircuts I've ever had. And then there might be one about, you know, when Groove Armada came out and Groove Deck came along. Or it's sort of like I wrote it quite randomly. And then at the end, I sort of shuffled it into an order for my editor because I first sent it over and she went, how am I supposed to read that? And I thought, oh, yes, that doesn't make any sense. But I don't know how else to write. And I thought I'll just write it like a stream of consciousness, like I'm telling someone. And then I thought, I don't really want to read that back. Like, I've done that now. So, yeah, I got the notes and I went through the bits that needed a bit of sharpening or whatever, repeated myself, which was very easy to do. But yeah. I didn't feel afraid. I just thought, I'll just chuck it all down there and then that's me, basically.
I mean, it's very honest. It's very open. There's lots of funny stuff in it. There's some the stuff that definitely isn't funny in there. So it does feel like... I mean, I think both the child, you know, your child is very interesting because obviously you're in a slightly showbiz environment as you're growing up with your both your parents being involved in the media in one way or another. So obviously your mum was in Blue Peter, but also Jigsaw, which was better than Blue Peter because it had Nell Gwynn in it. So did you always felt like you were going to be famous, or you wanted to be famous?
I think I was intrigued by a lot of it.
Yeah.
But I did definitely always like the idea of doing something. It wasn't like I just wanted to be famous, because I could also see that that didn't necessarily lead anywhere in itself. But I think I was intrigued by that as something that can go along with some jobs.
Yeah.
But it really, when I found music, it wasn't, I mean, I was 16 by then, and it wasn't about fame at all for me then. It was just, I absolutely love this. So I think maybe that bit of being intrigued by fame had kind of gone away by then. I think it was just, there was a bit in my childhood, maybe when I was about 5 or 6, when I realised that what my mum did and the fact that a lot of other kids knew who my mum was wasn't typical.
Yeah.
And I think I just was trying to figure that out. And bits of it I was really excited by, like when I had my 8th birthday and we got to go to Madame Tussauds and we skipped the queue. And I was like, this is genius.
Right. If that happened now, you'd be cancelled. It's lucky that people didn't know about that.
Don't worry, I have no intention of doing that. I'm not going to do it. But yeah, but then I think, yeah, as I got older, I was looking more for something that, you know, made me excited and suited me. And music was definitely that.
And it's, but you know, it is a very, that's an, it was an interesting time to come into that world. And you're right about the sort of, you know, it was sort of the late 90s, really, wasn't it, when you were sort of coming into the music business? But it was that kind of Ladette culture that you were sort of influenced by. And it was a very odd time, and almost like a little antechamber between the present and the past in terms of attitudes towards sex and, you know, and male and female relationships and stuff. So it's the book's very open about that. I hope, and I think I'd really recommend the book anyway, but I think to any young people, it's very interesting. I mean, you talk about wanting to teach your sons about consent and the importance of that. But I think it's, you know, in both in terms of your feeling of self and your lack of confidence really in yourself and that I think has come about through your work. You've obviously got quite a positive and, you know.
Yeah, and having good people around me.
But back in those teenage days, it was a different, difficult time.
It's a roller coaster for lots of people, isn't it? But I think when you were talking about that, like, Ladette era, I think I felt like that was, there was a lot of things I was thinking about it that I thought no one else was. And now whenever I meet peers, I'm 42, and whenever I meet peers, they always actually say the same sort of thing. And I think, oh, it wasn't just in my mind. It really was quite a, not necessarily that healthy, a lot of the things that were going on. It was quite a tough circus to be thrown into when I started out, I think.
Yeah, and as a female in the music business, I mean, I think you say, you know, the people went before you had help, but it was still a very male dominated business.
Yeah, and you expected to sort of, it was a bit sink or swim as well. Yeah. Just get on with it and trying to be bawdy and keep up with the lads. And I actually just felt like an imposter with all of it. I thought, that's not really me. I felt quite square on the inside. And now I realise that's completely fine.
Yeah.
Of course. The joy of growing older. Oh my God, I love that.
Yeah.
But at the time,
you know, you had a lot of success very early on. I think through the force of your personality and your self-belief, in a way that most musicians, I think, don't keep it going, but, you know, you've kept things going and on your own terms.
Well, I love what I do, but I can't really take credit for that, because I've been lucky enough to surround myself with some people who I think are amazing.
Right.
And I often feel like I'm the least talented person in the room, and I don't mean that in a self-effacing way. I mean it in the best way, where you're just with these people, you're like, God, they're amazing, they're so good at what they do, and it makes you want to be better. And I think that's great. I fell on my feet with a few people early on with my solo career, and it taught me the importance of those relationships, actually, because if you've got the good people around you, then you can always seek them out, can't you? Like, they're like a you know, a rock that you can cling to when everything else is a bit, you know, up and down. Like, they're the good people, and if you stick with the good people, it tends to see you right, I think.
Yeah, I would think that's definitely true, but I think there must be something about you, because I think that is driving it. Because, you know, not just in music, you know, you've done in lots of, I mean, just obviously more recently in lockdown, the the kind of kitchen disco and the podcast you're doing, which the book has come out of.
Yeah.
You know, it is. It's. I'm not saying it's not like you're driven, because it's you are. You know, I think you've got your priorities all right. And I think that's why the kitchen disco thing works so well, because it's you're a sort of international pop star, but it's you in your house with your kid with your kids running around just behaving like everyone's kids do. Isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Real life. And going back to, you know, keeping going, I think it, with me, I never had a plan B. I don't think there's anything else I'm qualified to do. I really love what I do for a living. And I think, especially after the Kitchen Discos, was about so many things. It was about giving ourselves something to do, my husband Richard and I, something to do when we were feeling, you know, the pressure and the heaviness of what was going on in the world. It was doing something a bit silly and fun. It's connecting with people and forming that community. But also, it reminded me how much I love music. Like, isn't music incredible? Even when we were not able to go anywhere, you could play a song and it could take you right back to some amazing memory. Like, I just love that about music. It's the cleverest thing ever.
But you've, you know, out of lockdown, which obviously it was, you know, it was a bit of a phenomenon, but you've toured it. And it's now we're back out of lockdown, so it's become like a big thing. Did you envisage it being more than just some messing around in your house?
No way, are you kidding me? I mean, the first one we did, I literally ended the first broadcast saying to Richard, I think that's my career over, you know. No, I thought I'd gone a little bit loopy, like very early on into this. But I think, I mean, the Kitchen Disco being a live touring thing was part of something that halfway through, and probably a lot of people felt like this, you know, we had the first bits of lockdown, and you thought, oh, this is temporary, my life is on pause, and then as soon as we're allowed to, we'll go back to what we're doing. And then there came this turning point, you think, oh, hang on a minute, that's not quite how this is going to work. This is going on a lot longer than we expected, and it's going to be a thing we all have to, it's going to shape our lives a bit. Mm-hmm. You know, we've literally all had sort of gone on another fork. So I think taking it on the road was just a lovely thing to acknowledge that part of our lives, but also give it a really happy ending, because then we got to actually see people and do those discos, but with a live audience, which is glorious.
Yeah.
But also it's a little bit, I mean, you know, if I'm not singing, I already was doing sort of disco and dance, and then if I'm not singing in my kitchen, then I'm basically just doing my day job anyway. So hopefully, like, the singing and the touring was always going to happen again. But,
sure.
Yeah, calling it Kitchen Disco has just meant it's an opportunity to have that lovely feeling with lots of people. And it's been the most amazing year taking it around the place. And
it is so good that that's gone. I mean, it's love, again, out of the book, but also clearly, just from the longevity of the relationship, that your relationship with your husband Richard is so lovely, and I think that's what's inspirational about it. I think you went through obviously some quite unpleasant experiences, and had a very unpleasant boyfriend before you met Richard, and you know, just he seems like a very nice person, and you seem to have got together, and it really works. And I think that's good to read about, because I think again most people will have experience something along those lines.
Sure. But and sometimes you don't actually think the happy ending's waiting for you, actually, when you're in a relationship that's not great, because that's the way you first learn what a relationship's supposed to look like. Yeah. And if it's not very healthy, you think, oh, this must be how it's supposed to be. And so when I got together with Richard and he was kind and supportive, it was like a revelation that, oh, I didn't actually believe that could really be how things could be. And yeah, we just have a lot of fun. And we were friends first, so I think, you know, we really like each other. Obviously, you know, sometimes we really drive each other crazy, but we have a lot of things that we love doing together, and we make sure we share a lot of what we get up to.
Yeah.
I think for us that's been really important. So he's in my band again now, and as well as his own band, The Feeling. But so we tour together and we sort of have these little adventures in amongst all the stuff we're doing. It's fun.
And you fell pregnant very early in relationship, which but again, there's such that's such a defining moment, and it's obviously a defining thing of the
it's
relationship of whether someone hangs, you know, someone doesn't have to necessarily hang around.
Sure, we've been going out for 6 weeks when I realised I was having a baby, and I always find it quite funny. People are like, oh, did you plan that? I'm like, no, but my mum gave a really lovely bit of advice to Richard and I. She said, it might not be the right time and it might not be the right man, but it's the right baby. And I think that meant that we kind of felt like, okay, are we going to do this? Yes. So we knew we were having a baby together. And then we kind of just let our relationship, we sort of continued like we were still early dating. Yeah. So we didn't actually move in until 2 weeks before Sonny was born. And we would have these dates. And I don't know, I look back and it's all a bit funny, really, but it was very formative for us. And actually, Sonny was born early. He was 2 months early. So when he was born, we'd only been a couple for 8 months. So it was all quite quick. But he's 18 now, and
it's also within show business, and an 18-year marriage is like a 1,000-year marriage to a normal person. So it's a beautiful love story. I also found it very. I thought the groove this obviously Groovejet was like this big. The first thing I say, your first band was called the Audience, which I don't really want to talk about much beyond. It's really confusing in the book, even though...
What, calling it The Audience?
Well, because it's called The Audience, and you keep saying, I was in The Audience. You go, what? Why were you in The
you
Audience?
You know what? I knew that was stupid at the time.
Yeah.
I knew it, but, you know, there were like five of us, so...
I mean, I love it, because it's exactly like a sort of teenage, hey, let's we're the band, but let's call... Like, we're all part of the... So we're not better than The Audience. Let's call ourselves The Audience. Won't it be confusing when we... When we say
no,
the audience,
it was worse than that, Richard, because it was actually The Audience spelled all one word. So people were like, Theo Udience? I mean, it was just, it was stupid. I do think if you're going to call anything, it shouldn't really need like an explanation before you say the name or after, should it?
No.
It should just be. And
even though you explained in the book, when I listened to the audiobook every time it comes up, I was still confused.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. No,
sorry.
It's good. And then it made me laugh every time.
Maybe I should have sung it. The Audience. Just something just to like jolt you out of that.
No, it's good. It was funny. But the story of you, it's one of those, it's like a sliding doors moment, isn't it, with your dad, Peter Howitt. you getting the CD you sort of saw yourself as an indie performer and weren't interested in working with
dance music. Yeah, because I think, I mean, now we're really used to the fact that people can, you know, hop between different genres. That's completely normal. But in the 90s, things were not this way. You know, you nailed your colours to that mast, and I was very much an indie kid. You know, Melody Maker, Enemy every week, knew all those bands. They were all over my wall in my bedroom. So when the audience split up. I was high and dry, but the idea of moving into a different genre just wasn't in my head at all.
Yeah.
So when I was sent this instrumental track with a view to potentially singing on it, I was actually insulted. I was quite insulted. I'm an indie kid. Why on earth you sent me a dance track? And also that was like a different world, like the house scene. That was just breaking out into being more mainstream. That was still something that was mainly people going to Ibiza and, you know, that was where it was. And so it was all a completely, like, new world opened up once I said, actually, you know what, I'm going to do this track because there's something about it I like and I think maybe it's good for me to do something that's other and it'll just be my own thing and the music press on that side of it where even though I've done it, I'll just go and do it for me. And then it just took me on this incredible ride, showing me a whole new landscape.
And you threw the CD, the bit in the book you talk about, you listened to the CD and you threw it across the room because you weren't interested and then found it later and thought, oh, I'll have another listen.
Well, I didn't remember what it was. It was blank. So I was tidying up and I just found the CD. I'm like, what's that? And I put it in and I thought, actually, there's something I quite like, actually.
Yeah.
I like it.
I mean, there's in the Beatles story, there's this moment where Paul McCartney, where they come back from Hamburg and Paul McCartney goes back to his job and then gets offered a promotion. But then the other Beatles, they haven't performed together a bit, and they say, we're doing a lunchtime show at the Cavern, but you'll have to quit your job to come and do it. And I often wonder about the universe where Paul McCartney decides he'll take the promotion.
Oh, yeah.
And how different... And I'm not saying that
your
music... I'm not saying your music has been as influential as Paul McCartney's.
But no, if you hadn't remember what it was called at the beginning.
But if you hadn't picked up that CD a second time,
yes.
Do you think... I think that song was so instrumental in sort of the direction you were going to go in anyway.
Maybe Groovejet is my promotion. Maybe I should have kept it in the bin.
Maybe.
Who knows what would have happened in the universe.
Let's imagine that world. Let's imagine the world where Paul McCartney took the job. I'm absolutely fascinated by things like that.
Yeah, you do have like moments that are really pivotal. Yeah. And everything changed with that song. So it's... It's the song that taught me the most. And before it was even a hit, actually, before it even did well, it was already really significant to me because it was about a change in my mindset as well of just thinking, actually, I'm the person who's making the rules here. So if I want to do that song, I can completely do that song. And just having this adventurous way from things. And like when the song came out, my manager at the time said, oh, I wish you all the best, but I can't manage you anymore. So actually when it charted, I didn't have a manager. I didn't have a record label. So it was kind of... crazy and really stressful, but also really exciting because it was just brilliant to be doing something again and have this momentum and to think, and what next?
You sort of had a chart battle against Posh Spice.
Yes. It's so funny to think of that now. Yeah, that was crazy intense. Wow. So basically, Victoria Beckham was the last of the Spice Girls to release a solo single, and all of the others had had number ones. So there was a lot of pressure on Victoria to have a number one with this song called Out of Your Mind that she did with Dane Bowers.
Yes.
Yes.
And you beat her.
Well, the song did better, yeah. But it was really crazy, actually, because the song all week in the midweeks was behind her song. Oh, it's the True Steppers, that's right. True Steppers and Dane Bowers who did the song with. And all week we were behind them, and it was getting closer and closer till on the last midweek there was only 500 sales between them being number one and Spiller and I at number two. And then it went quiet on the Saturday, and I thought, oh, maybe I should just pop to Woolworths and buy it. What if there's only one single in it, and it was, and I'm the one? And I thought, no, I can't do it. I've never bought my own music. I'm not going to start now. And I went home. And then the next day, we'd sold 20,000 more copies on that Saturday, which is bonkers. And it was really exciting. And because I'd come from a band that had been dropped and, you know, being high and dry, I just really tried to take everything in. Because I knew at the time, like, that doesn't happen very often in anyone's life. So I was like, okay. Yeah. Try and remember it all.
And do you think your manager regrets letting you go before, just at that point in your career, or did he?
No, I don't think he did. He's a nice man. He's called Martin. I still see him around sometimes. And he wasn't. He was part of the indie side of things. I think, again, that shows, you know, it was still that old school way of, you know, he said, oh, I wish you all the best. I don't really quite understand what you're doing with the dance thing, but I wish you all the best. And he said, and one bit of advice, don't, you're going to get offers to go and sing in lots of clubs up and down the UK. Don't do it, because it's a bit of a, you'll get stuck there and you won't be able to emerge. And I was like, yeah. And then as soon as I got these offers, I was like, hell yes. I sang at literally all of those clubs. I was like, so happy to be working. I just thought, yeah, I don't care if I get, like, yes, count me in.
So you were driving around the country just doing like 10-minute spots in clubs and then doing another club. And
the quickest in and out was 11 minutes from pulling up to singing and then coming out. Because obviously I only had Groovejet anyway.
Yeah.
And so I'd go into these clubs and they were like, I don't know, called things like Equinox. And I'd have to wait in the manager's office before they'd call me out into the main club. So you'd get there and it'd be like 1 a.m. and coming through the walls. And there'd be like some like page 3 calendar on the wall and bright lighting. And I was like, oh, man. And then you'd get pulled out and they'd often not know who I was. So I'd either get introduced to Spiller or they'd say, like one night they said, Sarah Alabaster. And I was like, whatever. Sing Groovejet. Thank you. Back in the car.
Would people like blow, did that blow people's minds that you were actually turning up in clubs?
No, because that's very much the thing. You know, if you've got like a house hit, then I used to see other singers doing the same thing. It was a circuit, you know, a lot of female singers would be backstage and then they'd go out, and some of them were singing on maybe 2 or 3 really big songs, like songs you'd know, you know, things that were all over the radio. I was just really grateful. I mean, I'd really come from thinking that was the end of my singing career. So to be back working was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was 21 then.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few celebrity stories in the book, but I think the one I like the best was a bit before this. I think was when you met Jarvis Cocker.
Oh, God, and that's so
this is a great great story.
Something on my cheeks going pink. Oh God, it's really embarrassing. Actually, I met Jarvis at a party, and he was talking to me. It was just before This Is Hardcore came out. And he was being quite quite open, actually, because he'd had massive success with the previous record. What's the one called? The one was called Common People on it. And Different Class, yeah, thank you. And so he was a bit nervous about This Is Hardcore. And we were chatting, and then I said, I've got to go home now, but if you want, my boyfriend's recorded the latest episode of Alan Partridge. Yeah. So if you want to come back, you can watch it with us at my flat. So we go back to my flat where there's my boyfriend, and Jarvis kind of comes in, and we had this tiny flat. I mean, it was minuscule. And so we were sat, there was one little sofa down one end and then one upright chair on the side of the wall. So Jarvis took the awkward upright chair and sort of sat on the side, like watching Alan Partridge. And I remember thinking, this is weird, because this is all we said we'd do, but no one seems to be really very chilled about it. And then he went to the loo and then he left. And then it was a rented flat in Camden, just above the World's End pub. And after he left, I went into the bathroom and I saw that he'd basically, the previous occupants had put a massive Pulp sticker on the underside of the loo. So when he'd gone to the loo, he would have seen this and would have thought either that we were like massive fans or we really didn't like Pulp. It was just so embarrassing. I could never really quite put my finger on why it was so
I mean, I
awkward.
Think he I thought like a, that...
Yeah, I know.
But I mean, I know you were talking about Alan Partridge and say, I've got the latest episode, but I think he must have thought, you know, we're not going back to watch Alan Partridge.
I'm so green. I was like, I don't get it. We're literally just watching Alan Partridge. Like... Come on, guys.
I think it's a lovely image of him sitting there and not watching, and he probably quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, it's a very good show. And I really like Jarvis, and I hope he's okay with that now. I haven't really spoken to him about it ever.
Okay, I'll get him. I'm going to get him on this podcast and just ask him about that.
Please, make it right for me, please.
I bet he went back to loads of people's places and watched Alan Partridge, probably. Yeah. Glam Metal Detectives, he probably was watching. Bet he liked Glam Metal Detectives. And you had a sort of beef with Robbie Williams.
Yes.
Would you say it was? I mean, he was quite nasty to you, but you were. You're sort of apologising.
I definitely
to him.
Started it, yeah. But we have actually subsequently totally made up. It bothered me for years.
Right.
But yes, when I was again in the audience, we were offered a support slot with Robbie, and I didn't want to do that because I was. You know, I came from such a music fan side of the tracks that to me, if you had a band support another band or artist, whatever, I thought that meant like thumbs up both ways. You know, if you support someone, that means I think this person's great. I've got all their records. And I didn't feel that way about Robbie. He wasn't someone I supported. I didn't, you know, play his music. Mm-hmm. So stupidly, the inter-band discussion about it went public and I wasn't very nice about him on TV. And he saw it and it upset him. And it did bother me for years because that's just not how I would handle anything now. I would never talk about someone like that. I think I thought I was being quite clever. He was such a massive star. And the idea, I thought there's no way he's going to see little old me. And so I felt like it was quite clever being really mean about someone really successful. Yeah. So, yeah, it bothered me for years. And I wrote this letter and I was just like, look, you don't have to do anything. This is not on you to forgive me, but I just want you to know that that is really not how I am. And I'm raising my kids to be kind, and I would be horrified if they did something like that. So I'm really sorry. And actually, he wrote back to me really quickly and was completely lovely. And I really feel very differently about that. But, you know, you say some stupid stuff when you're young, don't you? You just come out with bollocks.
You know, that's what this interests about the book, because you're so you're so young and you're very you are naive and trusting and it's heartbreaking, but it also is just so I think it's a sort of not universal, but everyone will have been through similar things on some level.
So.
Certainly, I think.
I hope so, guys.
And so I think it's really great for you to write about it. And I think it's, the personal stuff in there that I think is really important to write about, because it's also, I think, experiences that, that aren't the big, oh, this massively terrible thing happened to you, but it's still terrible things happening to you on a level that probably happened to a lot of people.
Well, I also think, what's the point of writing a book if you're not going to talk about stuff that's happened to you? I just couldn't... Sure. It'd just be so... You know, I didn't want to play it safe. And anyway, that's not... Again, that's a nice thing about getting older. You just... I don't really feel like I've got anything to hide anymore, really.
No. It's good, no, but it's interesting. And you were just a, you know, you, when you're talking about this Robbie Williams thing, you were like a teenager. You were just basically just a kid.
Yeah, I was 18. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's absolutely. You know,
I'm still living in the Alan Partridge flat.
Yeah. And he wasn't a teen. He was rude about you as well. So I hope he apologised, even if you started it.
Yeah, yeah. He was like, oh my God, why is that bothering you? Like, don't worry about it. It was the 90s. We're all horrible about everybody. But,
yeah.
Nah.
It was a really...
Not my style.
It was a horrible decade. I was right in the middle of it, and it was a horrible, horrible decade. So it's nice to see that spelt out. but you've recently... We'll move on to the other endeavours, I'm quite interested on your Wikipedia page. You do mention an audition you did in the book as well, but it says that you auditioned for Moulin Rouge. But
I did meet with Baz Luhrmann and sang him a song and had a chat about it. He was talking to lots and lots of different singers at the time. I think he wasn't really quite sure who his... Satine, I think the name of the characters would be. But I really liked him, actually. We spent about an hour together. And I just enjoyed having the experience a bit because I'd love Strictly Ballroom. And I was, happy to chat to him. It was fun.
And you auditioned to be a Bond girl?
Oh, I did, yeah. Wow. That was really fun. I learned how to do a bit of fencing.
Right.
I had to fire a gun. It was all... I had to go to, Pinewood and do a proper screen test, which I found really exciting, although also... A little bit embarrassing because I think that was maybe like the third callback or something.
Right.
I think I'd got down to the last three and they had this scene they wanted me to do, but they wanted me to look like I was naked. So I had to buy like nude colour underwear. Honestly, it was mortifying. And the guy that I did the scene with, a really lovely actor called Colin Salmon, but then I ended up knowing him. He's like Dan from The Feeling, Richard's band. He's like his neighbour and we met and... He said to me, I said, oh, we did that casting together. And he went, yes, and I just want you to know I didn't say any of the things. And I said, sorry, what? And he went, nothing. So whatever it was he said, apparently he didn't say. But it was probably just that I wasn't very good.
Not if you got to the third. It's sort of interesting to get that close. Would you have liked to do... I mean, I know you have done some other acting as well, but would you? Is that like a... Is it something you want to return to? Because this obviously was a first. It was your first
Rose,
indication.
I mean, I peaked with Rose Garrett.
You certainly did. I mean, that's the thing. People would always be comparing you to that role.
Exactly.
And I'm saying, why isn't she being carried up to bed by someone who's not big enough to carry her?
It's true. I don't know. I think my thing with acting is, I think you have. I wouldn't want to be. I'd want to be in something that would be flipping awesome whether I'm in it or not, so that it's, you know, no pressure on me. And I think as well with the Bond thing, it was interesting actually. I actually didn't really want to do it, and I remember lying awake in bed after I'd done the casting and thinking, if they offer it to me, I'm gonna have to say yes, because you don't really turn that down. But I don't really feel like in my heart that's exactly what I want to do next. So I think I feel like the right thing at the right time, maybe. But
which Bond was it? Would it have been?
This was Die Another Day.
Right.
Yeah. So Rosamund Pike was the part that who's obviously amazing. But I don't know. It's definitely not the thing. I think ever since I started singing when I was 16, I didn't really think that much about acting again after that. Really. It's definitely music is.
But were you? Have you been in Neighbours? Have you been? Were you in Neighbours?
Yes.
So you. That's.
I played myself.
I mean, that's bigger than Bond, really. Especially,
you know, I was just like, that's cool. Come on, and being in Neighbours,
what did you have to do?
Me is like, whoop. Well, it was a fascinating scene.
Yeah.
Gemma Donovan's character is by the riverside and by the Thames, because it was all they shot the whole thing in London.
Okay.
And she finds a diary that she thinks is her, I think either hers or her mum's diary, but no, it's mine. And then we end up having a whole chat, a little confessional chat. It's just a passing thing. We're just two strangers that meet, but it's a little moment we share together.
I saw one where they had the other bloke from Pet Shop Boys, Chris from the Pet Shop Boys. Have you seen that? Chris Lowe.
He's in Neighbours.
He was in Neighbours. There's a scene where
I didn't know that.
Where he drives into Ramsey Street and two of the old ladies are talking, and then he goes, I mean, he's driven into a cul-de-sac, and he goes, oh, do you know where the studio is? And they go, yeah, it's like a mile down that the road over there. He goes, oh, thanks. And then he says, I think he says it's the Pet Shop Boys, and then one of the younger characters comes and goes, oh, is that the Pet Shop Boys? Oh. And he drives away. It's fucking the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
That's amazing.
I mean, why is he driven into a cul-de-sac when he's looking for a studio? There's something weird going on with Chris Lowe.
I think that's, he's probably the same as me. He's just like, that's, come on. It's good on the CV.
Were you just passing the filming and they said, we'll put you in? Or was it arranged beforehand? Because that's what it felt like with Chris. It felt like Chris Lowe had actually just driven onto the set. And thought, we don't know who this guy is. It's Chris Lowe, not even the other guy, not Neil Denon. It's like
you're quite Lowe. Right. I was sitting by the river and I was just writing in my diary. And yeah, no, I did know. And actually, we had to film it at something crazy, like 6 a.m. So right. Like if it's, no, I thought it was a hoot.
Yeah. And Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
How did you get into Game of Thrones? I don't remember you in Game of Thrones.
No, and you wouldn't be able to spot me. Richard and I are both in the fight scene that was in episode 3 in the final season.
Okay.
It's the massive fight that a lot of people got annoyed about because it's quite dark.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that one. But they took 6 weeks filming that, round the clock, so two units, daytime, nighttime, and we did the nighttime shoot, and we had to fight the White Walkers. And I got some armour. It was really fun.
If we look out for you, will we see you? Or you...
No. I don't think so. But it was actually really cool. And a lot of the people that are in it have been doing... They've been extras in it since the beginning.
Right.
So I was chatting to some of them. They're like, I've died 6 times. I've died 8 times.
Why did you do this? And how did
just
this
for fun.
Well, like, you just rang them up and said, can I be in the...
Pretty much, actually. Yeah. I wrote an email and I said, okay. I've heard a rumour that it's possible to be an extra. If it's true, I would love to come. And actually, I think because they've been filming this very long fight scene, I think they basically felt like they had to keep it a bit stimulating for the cast. And so they had different people every night. So I think the night before had been a chess champion. The next night was going to be some American football player. So it was like... And everybody was really lovely. And the first bit we walked in, there was this big tarpaulin tent filled with about like 200 blokes who all had the same beard. And it was amazing. Like, oh yeah, oh, Game of Thrones people. Although I did feel like a little bit of a wally because we were really excited to be there. But I'd just done a little gig the night before, or maybe 2 days before, for this luggage company called Tumi. Make very nice but quite posh luggage, and we'd been given these amazing like little monogram pull-alongs, and I walked into this tarpaulin tent with my little monogram pull-along, and I was like, I feel like such a prat right now. But it was really fun. I'd like a little bit of mud on my face.
Yeah,
killed a bit of dragon glass. Come on. Don't seem very impressed by her fun.
I'm just sort of bamboozled. You're
baffled by me.
I'd wish I'd known it was an option, but I don't think they would have let me. I like the bit in the book where you persuade Richard to give up golf.
Oh,
because
yeah.
You don't like God. That's quite, I mean, it's quite
conniving.
Sneaky. Conniving, sneaky.
I know.
So he got into golf.
Yeah.
You did not approve of him getting into golf. I mean, he's here. I feel very sorry for you, Richard.
No,
he
you
loved
don't.
Golf. He had all the gear.
Yeah.
He looked great with his monogram tops on.
No, I don't, come on.
In his 20s.
It's so unsexy.
It is pretty unsexy.
I was like, I'm not having this. So for his 30th birthday, I got him 5 flying lessons. And I was like, I wrote in the card, golf is really unsexy, so if you've got to be spending time away from me, at least make it something sexy. So flying was it. And then I put the golf clubs in the attic myself.
This is how you keep a marriage going for all this time in show business. It's pretty good. And now you get to, you co-own a plane, or you've got
not a... Not me, Richard co-owns a plane. Yeah.
He's your husband, it's yours.
Oh, well, I get, okay, but he flies me places, which is really cool sometimes.
That is pretty good.
Yeah, it is really fun.
Blimey. That's proper show business. That is proper show business.
It is show business.
Let me ask you some emergency questions while there's still time.
Emergency questions?
Yeah, well, this is what they're called. This is just this.
Oh, okay.
You know, those stupid questions I was asking you backstage.
Oh, I like them.
I'll ask you some more. I'm going to go from early on. Have you ever seen a ghost?
No.
No.
Do you believe in ghosts, guys?
No, they're not real.
Me neither. No.
I thought you might believe
so
in ghosts.
I used to be so scared of them. No, I would like to, actually, but no, I just... No, it doesn't work, does it?
I don't think so. That, you know, as I get older, I'm haunted more, but really by the past. If you ask Alexa if ghosts are real...
What does she say?
Try it. Try it at home.
I will.
My son is obsessed with ghosts.
Well, I was when I was a kid. Yeah. And I was petrified as well. I could not sleep at night worrying about it.
My son's scared. Do you think if you ask Alexa, are ghosts real?
Oh, she's supposed to definitely say absolutely not.
She should say, don't worry, Ernie. No, they're not real. She doesn't say that.
Oh, no. Oh, that's terrible. I'm sorry.
It's very scary.
Alexa's let you down.
She has, but it's fine. If you had to have sex with an animal, Sophie.
Oh, God.
If you had to. Yeah. You can choose which animal it is. Which animal would you have sex with?
This is an emergency question.
Yeah.
How big an emergency are we in to get to that? I thought we were feeling quite relaxed.
This is how we find out a bit about your psychology. And also the Daily Mirror. The Daily Mirror can put Sophie Ellis-Bextor wants to fuck a dog.
There you go, a little bit of clickbait for you. There is one of those things, isn't there, where it's like, what's your favourite colour? What's your favourite animal? Oh, you want to have sex with like a three-legged yellow cat or something.
Oh, yeah.
So there you go, I'll have a three-legged yellow cat.
Three-legged yellow cat. Wow, that is going to be quite a pull quote for the day. Just thank me, Dave. Just link to the podcast. All right, this is... if you could go into a chrysalis, like a caterpillar, and you dissolve, because that's what happens to caterpillars, but then you turn into something, but you can turn into anything you want to, what would you emerge from the chrysalis as?
Oh, the pressure, because I'm so literal, all I can think is butterfly.
Wow, like... that's pretty good.
No, okay.
It could be anything, but a butterfly's nice.
Well, maybe I could just go for someone living a really different life.
Be
a little boy growing up, on like an island somewhere on the other side of, the world.
You can be that if you want.
Just do something, thanks.
You'd like to turn into a little boy, in Fiji or Australia? Yeah.
Just me and my three-legged yellow cat.
Okay. That's some good... and if you could, if all the world's museum and art galleries got together, which they might do by the sound of your life, because you've already been in Game of Thrones, just to say, I want to be in Game of Thrones, and I am. and they said, we love your work. We love Murder on the Dance Floor so much. We'd like to give you one item from any of the museum or art gallery in the world for you to keep. What would you like to have?
Oh, really?
Yeah, which... what?
That is cool.
Yeah, what would you like?
Oh, wow. I mean, there's so many things that would be really beautiful. But actually, the thing that's really popped into my head is that amazing painting of the Lady Jane Grey in the National Gallery.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
I don't know if... I mean, it's an unusual one to want to look at every day.
It is, but it's
But I
nice
do
one.
Love the painting.
What do you love
We were
that?
Talking about it the other day, so that's probably why it's fresh in my mind.
Okay.
You must know the one I'm talking about, do you? Where I think it was painted in the late 1800s.
Right.
But it's of, the 11-day queen. So she's only 16 and she's got her blindfold on and there's the... guy waiting with the axe and she's trying to find the block and it's really huge and it's one of those paintings you can really stare at for a long time. And as I said, I was having a chat about it the other day, so I think that's why it's fresh in my mind. If I had it on the wall, really, people would be like, whoa, bold choice. But I just think that it'd be nice to have a bit of art that you can keep seeing new things in every time you look at it. So let's go big.
No one's chosen that before.
I'm not surprised. Really. A teenage girl about to be beheaded.
Teenage girl's about to be killed. I mean, it's that's
don't
what,
analyze
that, what is what is life if that is not life? That's what life is. So tell us about your podcast. So your podcast is also called Spinning Plates. And how did that come? When did you start that? How did it come about?
Unlike you, I have a baby podcast. So it's been going 2 years. And... they're all conversations with working women who happen to be mothers. And that's kind of the icebreaker. So we sort of speak about how motherhood has affected them and affected their work. I find whenever I talk to my girlfriends or even women I've just met, the conversation always goes around to whether or not you have kids. And then normally a conversation about how it works with, doing your job and raising the kids. And I just find it always interesting, actually. So I've spoken to women from all different walks of life, from... like the doctor who helped develop the vaccine for COVID, through to Gina Miller, who took the government to court. I've spoken to ex-prime ministers. I've spoken to Spice Girls. Like, I just really enjoy it.
Yeah.
All the conversations are interesting. And like you you just have to actually really want to do it with the podcast, don't you?
Yeah.
It's like, has to come from a passion, I think. Otherwise, it'll just stop. So, But I haven't done as many as you. You've done... like over 400, I've done about 80.
Yeah, well, in 2 years, that's pretty good.
Well, I do really like it. I do. And I love the conversations. And I think I started it just before what turned out to be lockdown. And then during that time, it became really precious because these conversations were like the only time I could have a full conversation with someone and not be interrupted. So with the kids. So it was like really like, whoa, this is legitimate, proper chat that I can have.
Yeah.
And it was really precious to me. So I loved that very much.
Yeah. It's a very interesting subject, I think, as well, to, you know, I think to take so successful people and talk about how they got through, had to... Because it, you know, having a family does impact massively on your life, mainly in a positive way. But it is suddenly you have to, you know, like today, if kids are ill, you suddenly have to make new arrangements.
It's something I think about a lot, and I think part of it, you know, a lot of these things are selfish, aren't they? And I think for me, it helps me still give myself permission to really enjoy my work and not feel that guilt that I used to feel so much. I mean, I still do a bit, but it's allowed me to balance, recalibrate that a little bit. Plus, you get to speak to me. I did one with Mary Berry the other day. I mean, she's just such a lovely woman. You're like, this is so nice. I just have to get to have a really lovely conversation. And she did, of course, make a cake.
That's nice.
So lovely. Salted caramel. It was delicious.
Oh, very nice.
It was.
Did you make me a cake for coming on here?
Yes.
Oh, good. I'll look for I left it in the cloakroom.
Oh, I left it at home. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Never mind. I'm trying to watch my weight anyway. I'm failing. And do you book it all yours? Do you book the guests yourself? We were talking about this, but a little bit on stage. Are you finding that okay? Have you got a good
I've had to overcome or? My... I often do complete, like, shot in the dark, like, just find a contact on someone's webpage or anything, and I find it really cringy. But I think it's quite good for me, that, because I'm inherently quite shy about it. So it means I just have to get over the awkwardness and just put yourself out there. And, you know, the worst thing someone can say is no, right?
It's true.
And every once in a while, someone you're really excited about says yes, and then you get all excited, and then, like, you have to do all the... reading about them and working out what to, you know, you want to talk about. But I like it. I really enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, in the book, you do talk about being quite shy and, like, socially, that, again, Richard's brought you out of your shell a little bit. But it's kind of interesting. You would think you would be a very outgoing sort of party animal kind of person. From
the impression I give?
I think you would think that from... Well, just because you're a pop star, I think. But it's quite. I mean, I think that's the appeal, isn't it, of the stuff you've been doing recently? Is that it's on the one hand you are this pop star, and you know that's a very high status and mysterious thing, and yet you're sort of allowing people into your real world, showing the real you as well.
Yeah, and I think also that whole mystique about that became. It's lovely to, you know, if you want to be someone that lives this life of mystery and you've got your stage persona and, you know, private life, I get that completely. And I think I did that for quite a long time. And then I realised that I felt really comfortable to just be more myself, really. And so the gap between how I perform and how I act off stage is really closed. It's sort of one and the same. And it's made me a lot happier, actually. And I really enjoy in that. And I mean, like, Lord knows, on stage, I will go off on any kind of tangent. There's, like, bits of vague... I mean, I can call it stand-up, but I don't know if it's actually all those funny, but I just go off on these little, like, wandering up and down, telling my little jokes.
Yeah.
But I think I'm just a lot more at peace with that, really. That little voice in me, you know, that used to do the kind of critique of what I was up to while I was on stage, has got a bit quieter, so I'm having fun. But you know, the need to be sort of gregarious and going out. I've always been I like being a homebody. I'm happy with that. And I have a lot of really fun times with my work going out anyway. So I'm often not really seeking it outside of that.
Yeah.
I get my quota.
It does feel like, you know, there's a journey here and you know, and it feels like you're a very centered and sorted person. Certainly now it feels like you've...
I hope so.
So you talk about your goal being to be unapologetic, which I think is a...
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool?
It is. It's a great...
Yeah, I always find that so admirable in people.
Do you think you're getting there? I mean, not being unapologetic isn't like not apologising for things you've done wrong.
No, it doesn't mean being rude either. No. It just means being yourself, I think, and not feeling like you need to sort of tread round things to just make yourself feel like you're making decisions you like. But I think a lot of it as well comes from really good role models. I mean... In this chat, I feel all roads eventually go back to my mother. And she is an amazing role model. And so she's always come across to me as someone who seems really happy. She's pragmatic. It doesn't mean you don't feel all the sad stuff and the big stuff, but I think she's done a good job of teaching my sister and I, my brother, like how to kind of find that balance, hopefully. But also it's counsel, isn't it? You've always got people in your life that provide you counsel. So if you are feeling a bit wobbly or worried, you've always got people to talk to. And Richard, of course.
Yeah.
And the kids, actually, too.
Yeah. It's really inspiring. And I think it is, you know, I hope that... I mean, you're doing so many different things. It's really interesting. And I think just in terms of, even as a musician, but I think especially as a female singer from the 90s, to still be, like, to be producing stuff and making your own direction and making your own work still, it's kind of quite unusual.
I mean, I'm really flipping lucky, definitely. I mean, I really do appreciate the fact that I still get to do the thing I love.
Like, yeah, but I think it's you. You know, I think it's down to your...
My little tenacious, plucky spirit.
I think it is. It's
You're taking a hint.
It's very, you know, I think it's a very inspiring story, and I think it just does show if you keep going and you keep finding... You've adapted, and you know you've done things like Strictly, obviously, which then is another world, and you are opening yourself up to
Paso Dobles.
Yes, well, but that's a big thing to do, isn't it? In terms of again putting yourself out there.
Yeah, like definitely like the most terrifying thing I've ever done. 100%. Yeah, lots of fun, but also like a lot of out of body experiences when you're about to do a cha cha on like my telly, like what? But yeah, there I was.
You don't seem to rate yourself as a dancer from in the book in your when you look back at your videos and things like that.
I don't think my technical, you know, dancing is that all that. But I do love a dance. And actually, when I did a dance-a-thon last year where I had to dance for 24 hours for children in need, and really near the end, someone had come on stage to come and see me, and I was getting a bit delirious by then, and I was like saying, "Oh, I know I'm not really a very good dancer," and he said something like, "No, but you look like someone I would like to go dancing with." And I thought, oh, actually, that's really sweet.
Yeah.
I thought, I'll take that. If I can have that, you know, that rapport with the audience when I'm doing a gig, like, oh, that's lovely. I'd much rather that than being an amazing dancer, just someone you feel you can dance with. That's nice.
It's a very nice thing to say, and I'm sure it's true. Oh, and also, I mean, I was just listening. I was listening when I was driving.
Yeah.
And there's so many things I want to ask you that have fallen out of my head because I'm so old and ridiculous. But was your music the first music ever on an iPod?
Yes, Groove Chat.
That's insane.
That's pretty insane, isn't it?
So that was the first track ever put on an iPod?
Yeah, when they had the prototype iPod, they used Groove Chat as the first thing to test if it was working with like Steve Jobs there and everything.
Wow.
My little voice popping out. That's literally the coolest thing I've done, according to my kids. Like, I can't top that.
I mean, it's a good trivia question, but it's also, that's it's sort of like going to the moon. you're sort of like the Neil Armstrong of our generation.
I think of it that way too. I'm glad you said it, not me, but I think of it that way too.
So we can carry the podcast. It's well worth buying the book. Get the audiobook, but do remember each time she says the audience is not... Sometimes she's talking about the audience, but sometimes she isn't talking about the audience.
I'm sorry, guys.
It's not your fault. It's the person who named the band. and the Kitchen Disco Tour, is it ongoing? Is it going to go forever?
Well, we did it all with the festival. Yes, we'll do more. And I think we might do another tour next year, actually.
Right.
A Christmas Kitchen Disco Tour. Yeah. Have some Christmas songs in there.
And your tour, and you've got, it's your new album.
Yeah, out. Coming out in spring. Oh my gosh, I can't wait, actually. I started doing that before lockdown, so yes. I think it's the 7th?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, let's say 7. Yeah, that's amazing. Pretty sure. Yeah, no, it is.
And are you going to be on Neighbours when it comes back?
I'll be driving into that cul-de-sac. Like, where do I go?
Yeah. I'm thinking, let's try and get... If you can email people who get on TV shows, why don't you email Neighbours and say, I just want to recreate the Chris Lowe scene exactly, but with me as Sophie Ellis-Bextor.
Yep, I'm going to do that.
And then they can go, didn't that other guy come in here? Why? They should signpost the... we can work on it together. Look, it's so lovely to meet you properly. And thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Do listen to Sophie's podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, the amazing Sophie Ellis-Bextor!
Thank you,
Sarah Alabaster!
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you. You have been listening to A Hullastapper with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Sophie Ellis-Bextor. Thank you to Scant Regard, who do the music for these titles, that I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. I'm also indebted to Chris Evans, not that one, and everyone he knows, especially his family, who seem to do all the work for him now. He's a sort of feudal lord, employing them all to do his dirty work for him. Thank you to the Leicester Square Theatre for having us for this fantastic run. We're back here from January to March, so do come and see us. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who's said hello so far. Do come say hello after the show if you enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.